Good morning, everyone. It's really wonderful to be back with all of you and to be able to share this particular Sunday service with you. As many of you know, a group of us just last week returned from a spiritual pilgrimage that we took in Italy. We went to a lot of very sacred spots, and I hopefully be able to incorporate some of what we received there into this talk today. I mentioned to some of my friends that Dumbara, who used to work here, he was part of a work and serve and live. He was a very big part of Ananda Palo Alto for many, many years. Always used to say to me, if anybody in the congregation goes on pilgrimage, we all benefit. And that's been true, me being on the other side of other people going. And now I hope to be able to bring just some of that to you. It was quite an extraordinary time that we've had. And I know many of you have read a letter that I wrote, but we went through Italy and we visited many of the great Catholic saints, the great mystics. We started in Assisi, where Swami Kriyananda, who founded Ananda, spent much of his time. And then, and also, of course, St. Francis lived there his whole life, and St. Clare. And then we moved on and we visited St. Catherine, St. Margaret. We were in the home and meditation cell of St. Joseph. And then we traveled down south a little bit, and we spent a couple of days in the hometown of Padre Pio, which is called San Giovanni Rotondo. Well, it was a deeply, deeply moving, compelling time. And one of the things that kept coming clear to me as we traveled and spent time in all of these sacred places where they lived, where they prayed, where they meditated, where they received the stigmata, all of the stories that we ever hear about the saints, we went there and we stayed there and we meditated there and we felt them there. We didn't feel that they used to be there. We felt them there right now. We felt their energy. They were as alive as ever. And we heard their stories, both because their stories were being told to us by the people who were leading us on pilgrimage, who've lived in Italy for many years now, the leaders of Ananda Assisi, but also because when you sit in these extraordinary places that these saints have sat, and as Yogananda said to us when he said his vibration, his energy is planted in the ether. In his book, he said that about autobiography of a yogi in the water at Lake Shrine. He said, from now on, this will be considered holy water. He didn't say, until 5 years after I die or 10 years after I die. He said, for those of us who in 2015 might go down there and be near a lake shrine, that is holy water. Well, when you're in that environment, you get to know these saints in a way that is so beyond one's ability to comprehend it, understand it, analyze it, get it intellectually, even absorb it by all of the stories that we've read. You're sitting in their energy and you know something about them that in some ways it's completely irrational. There is no other way to know it. Well, one of the things that you quickly feel about these saints' lives is just how much effort every one of them needed to put in order to bring God's love to us. Now, many of those saints lived in medieval times, and the buildings that they lived in are medieval buildings, and they're still standing, which is remarkable. You go and you touch a stone, and you know that St. Francis himself actually picked that stone up and put it there. You can sit right near the rock and meditate, the rock that he sat on when he prayed to Jesus, "Let me know all of the love and all of the pain that you ever knew." What extraordinary courage and knowing, not just all of the love, but all of the pain. And then he received the stigmata. And you're right there. It's an amazing experience, but it can look a little dark. You look at the clothes that he bled into, they're right there, the belts he wore, the hair shirts he wore, so that he could, what we would call, suffer a little bit. But really, I thought to myself just this morning, how else can he show us that we all need ways to remind ourselves continuously about the presence of God and continuously to be turning toward the light? If every time you move, there's a little bit of discomfort with a rough undershirt affecting you, but you set that up as, every time I feel that, I'm going to remember God. What a beautiful way to bring God into your life. And I realized when I was there that what they went through took an enormous amount of self-effort. It took an enormous amount of commitment. All of these saints suffered. We might know, more, many of us, more the stories of St. Francis, but we sat in St. Catherine's house. St. Catherine was so being denied her total awareness and love of God from the time she was a toddler, literally, that she cut off her beautiful long blonde hair so that she could no longer be able to be married off. She would no longer draw a man. St. Margaret, who was a wonderful saint, who made the horrible mistake of falling in love with a man, but was not allowed to marry him, having things to do with class and other things. So she ran away with him. This is in the early 1300s. Women did not run away with the man they love and live with them. And she lived with him for 10 years, and she had a child with him until 10 years later he was murdered. And what do you think? Do you think she was loved and accepted and thought of as a saint? But she had a transcendent, transformational experience through that love, through his death, and then moved on and became part of the Franciscan order and a great saint. I was reading yesterday that she it has been recommended that she be known as the patron saint of, I don't remember them all, but it was something like derelicts, homeless, sort of recovering prostitutes. Literally, this is what it says. She went from being considered a whore to being considered a saint. And she was actually made, if I'm not mistaken, she's one of the saints who was made, I could be wrong about this, she's definitely been canonized, but she might have been made a doctor of the church as well. And people make pilgrimage to her sites all the time. And then we go on and we visit Padre Pio's place, who lived in the 1900s, who also received the stigmata, who lived a life of excruciating pain, both based on those stigmata and because in his early life too, nobody knew he was a saint. People took him out of 3 or 4 schools that he went to, telling his parents he was stupid, he could never make it in these private schools that they were trying to send him to. These saints were not immediately recognized. Nothing was made easy. They didn't want it to be easy. Easy and hard don't mean the same things to them that it means to us. And as some friends of mine and I were talking just this past week, look at Yogananda and Kriyananda. Look at, I just reviewed last night a little bit of the book that John Parsons, the lawyer who helped us through the trial with SRF, wrote just a few years ago. But in it, he told many stories that a lot of us didn't know about the fact that Masters, one of his dearest friends from childhood, who he brought over to the United States, who he made a Swami, Swami Dhirananda, wound up suing him, taking him into court, really making his life miserable, were Master inclined, to have his life be made miserable. That 2 weeks before they were to have the dedication of Mount Washington, one of the big investors decided to take Master to court. She took him to court for committing fraud, and because she had donated money for Mount Washington. Master said in 1927, something I read yesterday, he said to people, "I easily work 23 hours a day." And look at Swami Kriyananda, everything that he went through, being ousted from his spiritual home, and after that, all he went through trying to start Ananda as we know it now, how many people wanted to fight with him, take over the land, take over the way the organization should go. All the surgeries he went through, writing books while he was in the hospital. We say these things, but how many of us could do them? It took a lot of self-effort. This is what the spiritual path takes. There's a wonderful story, one of the stories that Nayaswami Devi wrote in their blog, A Touch of Light, called Two Butterflies. I'm sure most of you read it, but it's a story of friends of hers who had a terrarium at home, and in it there were two, I'm going to get the plural word wrong, but chrysalises, or chrysalises. I think I'm adding an extra syllable in there. And they were waiting for these butterflies to hatch. And the first one hatched, and they watched it, and they said it was a very painful experience. The butterfly had to eat open a little hole and really struggle to get out of the chrysalis. And when it got out, it was exhausted, and it just sort of stood there for a while and collecting its energy again till it could pump fluid into its wings, and then these beautiful wings appeared. It was a gorgeous monarch butterfly. So this is a family with two little kids, and when they see the second one start to hatch, the little kids say to the parents, "Let's help it." And so they go and they get a very sharp knife and they cut the chrysalis open. And very much to their dismay and chagrin, the butterfly comes out and then just collapses and dies on the floor, just drops on the floor and dies. And Devi writes so beautifully about the spiritual meaning that we can get from this, of just how important self-effort is. Not just important, not just meaningful, but essential. It was essential. You could see it in the butterfly, that none of us could move on to make our, to move into our next spiritual bit of growth, our next spiritual understanding, if we didn't struggle, if we didn't have to work hard and push hard, that we would stay exactly as we are, that none of us would ever realize our full spiritual potential. So, of course, self-effort is necessary. That's part of what I felt from those saints. But in the end, every one of those saints does nothing but show us their extraordinary love for God, their pure joy. They didn't leave us notes that said, "Hey, don't do this, it wasn't worth it." Not one of them. You'll never read that. They all say, this is the path. This is what it looks like. And San Giovanni Rotondo, I didn't get this when I was there, and I didn't write about this. This came to me last night. There's a monument that was made. I don't know when it was built, but it's modern. I mean, even by my standards, it looks like a modern piece of architecture. And it's off of the main square in town, and it's this set of extremely steep steps. And even as you begin to climb up to the first plateau, up to the next, you never quite see the top. There's an illusion there. You keep thinking you're going to get to the top, but the top is further away than you think. So, but it's beautiful, and it's very inviting, and you walk up to the first landing, and there's Mary, and then you see these little roads, beautiful roads, not roads like in a street, but made out of gorgeous, not tile, but blocks of red stone. They're inviting, is what I'm trying to say. And as you start, and you have a choice, you could walk straight up these very steep steps, or you could turn right or left and go down one of these roads. And I did both. But as you take the roads the first time, you realize that they wind like this, and they crisscross. And they keep coming back to the center, and then you do it again, and you're back to the center. Even as I'm saying it, I'm realizing it's very much like our astral spine and the chakras. But on these roads are the 14 stations of the cross. And they're done magnificently. They're huge sculptures in some, I don't know if they're bronze or some type of a metallic substance, I don't know. But they're not just a plaque the way you might see them in a church. They're big, they're imposing, they're lifelike. And in those 14 stations of the cross, as we all know, is a huge amount of suffering. That's what it looks like. There is Jesus from the beginning picking up the cross, which is way too big for any human being to bear. You can see that. And then bearing his own cross, he picks it up further and further, and he walks, climbing this hill of Calvary, which is really what this represents. And when you get to the very top, there's Jesus. And I have to say, I didn't even get it at first, till another woman, I think it was Caitlin, said it to me. There's the resurrection. It's not a modern version of Jesus on the cross. It's Jesus being resurrected. It took all that effort, step by step, all that beauty, all that what could look like suffering, all of that willingness, all of that courage, all of that enthusiasm, all of what it took that we call self-effort to get to what we're all wanting to get to, which is the resurrection. And you stand up there and it just takes your breath away. There is, you can't describe it. It's beyond words, because what they've done is that architect had an extraordinary inspiration, and he made you walk the spiritual path. He made you move through your chakras and climb up through your astral spine to get to the point where you are resurrected, and you know that everything that we look at in life is but an illusion. You've never lived, you'll never die. And there you are, standing up at the very top of this hill, looking out over everything that is Padre Pio, a current day Catholic Franciscan mystic who bled, who suffered, who built hospitals for the homeless. And there you are, looking down on a town that only developed because he was there. There was no town. It's out in the desert. It's nowhere. And the other thing that you realize is that you just went from 1100, when Francis was born, to 1968, to 2015, really, and nothing has changed. They're all here. They're all telling us the same story. It is remarkable. Now, I mean, it's so much more than remarkable. It's life-changing. It changes your heart. You will never go back to being who you were. And when you stand up here and you try and put words to it, you realize it is so woefully inadequate. They love us so much. They love us exactly as we are. And they never give up on us. Not from St. Francis in 1100 to right now, nor will they ever. God loves us exactly as we are. We don't have to prove anything to him. We don't have to wait until we're better or different. That's the reading from the Bhagavad Gita today. And if you just meditate on me, I will make good your deficiencies. How beautiful is that? He doesn't say, get it all together and then come to me and I'll bless you. He says, just turn to me. Just meditate on me. And I will bring this grace into your life no matter who you are. I love you just exactly as you are. One of the other blogs from A Touch of Life that Joe Tisch wrote, I don't know the name of it right now. It's probably called Adoration of the Magi. It's probably what it's called because that's what it's about. But he tells a story of when they led the first pilgrimage in Italy and they went to Florence and they went to the Uffizi Museum. And the woman who was leading them said, there's no way we can do the whole museum, but I'll pick out the key pieces for you. This is, of course, one of, if not the greatest museum in the world. And when they were standing in front of the Adoration of the Magi, which is, of course, the Madonna and Child and what we suppose are the three wise men, Leonardo da Vinci's interpretation of it. This is his painting. She says to them, what do you see about this painting? And everybody makes guesses, but it's not what she has in mind. She says to them, I want you to notice that all of the light in the picture is emanating from the Madonna and the Child, and that everybody who is looking at them, their faces are illumined. And everybody who's sidetracked, looking around, not quite paying attention, they're in the dark. So when you look at this painting, you see that. It's amazing. Of course, saying to us, if we just what Krishna is saying in the Gita, keep turning and look to the light. Bring your willingness, bring your concentration, bring your enthusiasm. Bring your faith, bring your devotion, because that's what we're talking about. We're talking about willingness that is born of faith and devotion, not just strong willpower. We're talking about what Master brought to us in the form of the energization exercises for anybody who's taken Med 2. The greater the will, the greater the flow of energy. The greater our ability to keep turning to God, the greater the flow of His energy. There's a wonderful story that I heard some time ago about Helen Purcell, who's the director of our school. I wrote her last night and got her permission to tell this story. When she moved to Ananda, I don't know what year it was, but she moved there as a single mother with two young girls. Her girls were not yet teenagers. I don't know how old they were. Maybe 7 and 10, somewhere around there. The girls were not all that thrilled about moving to Ananda, to say the least. And the only place that was available for them to live in was an old shed. And this is what this mother and two little girls moved into. It was not easy. But she was on this spiritual path. And one day, it was actually New Year's Day, which just happens to be Helen's birthday, Swami Kriyananda was holding an open house in his home. It was New Year's Day. And it was snowing and it was cold, and her daughters, the girls, were away. They were not there. So she was walking over to Swamiji's, and she was talking as she went. And she said, it's a pure blessing for me to be here. I'm not asking for you to make anything different. I know I'm right where I want to be. But it would be so nice if you could hold my hand in a way that I could feel. If I could just know, she said in her prayer, that somebody was with me, I would feel so much better right now. I would feel so seen, so loved. And she gets to Swami Kriyananda's place, and she walks in, literally, out of the cold and snow. And he's standing there, and he's greeting everybody. The whole village was invited. And as she walks in, he just takes her hand, doesn't say a word to her, pulls her over to his side, and for the next 15 or 20 minutes, while he greets everybody else, he just holds her hand up against his leg. And when everybody had come in, he looks at her, he just smiles, a smile filled with love, and doesn't say a word to her. They just walk in. It's one story out of many, but what an extraordinarily beautiful, beautiful story that says, you turn toward the light. Helen did it that day in prayer, like Sister Gianna Monta. She didn't ask to have her circumstance changed. She asked to have something in her changed. What this saying from the Gita says to us is, God loves us. We don't have to figure that out. We need to figure out how we can love God. We need to do that with energy. Because if we do it passively, if we're sitting around waiting for God to come to us, what kind of magnetism does that have? Ramani said this morning in our purification service, she was explaining it before it started. So people come up, they kneel before one of the light bearers, and their first words, which you've all now heard many times, I seek purification by the grace of God. And Ramani said, the reason you start it, the reason you speak first before God answers you is because God can't come to us unless we align ourselves with him, unless we offer ourselves to him. I'm going to share in closing one more story with you, but this is our story. Years ago, Bharat was about to teach a class on magnetism up at Ananda Village. And he went and he asked Sudarshan, do you have a magnet that I could borrow? And Sudarshan, I wasn't there, but I heard, brings him what we would call the Maha magnet, the biggest, the magnet of all magnets. Apparently there were warning signs on it, don't put this near this. And Bharat, and this is so Bharat, I just love, he has a way of acting out the teachings on this path, which of course he does mostly in nature, but just so beautifully. He puts the magnet down on one end of a long table, and he puts a bunch of nails and pins on the other end of the table. And for the class, he just slowly starts moving the magnet slowly, slowly towards the pins. And at some point, all of the pins just turn. In a moment, the magnet gets close enough. All of the pins and nails just turn towards the magnet. Remember, this is Maha magnet. When the magnet gets close enough, they literally jump onto the magnet. Now, why did he do that? Because he knew that that magnet represents divine love. It represents all that the divine is. Now, the divine really doesn't keep coming closer to us, although certainly makes itself available to us. But in this case, we can't tell the pins and the nails to move. But where are the pins and the nails? We just start anywhere, right where we are, and we start moving towards that magnet just by saying yes, just by bringing self-effort. And at some point, without any further effort on our part, grace descends, and we're turning towards the light, which is towards this magnet. And if we keep going, now we need more self-effort. The tests don't get easier, right? It's not easy to be put on a cross and have nails put through you and to be given some vinegar to drink when you say you're thirsty. There's nothing we heard in 2 weeks in Italy that was easy. So what? We're talking about an eternity of joy. Does any of us think for a minute that the hurdles that we're going to be asked to jump over, that our tests are going to look like exactly what we thought they were going to look like, what we prepared ourselves for? Of course not. They're going to be a surprise every time. You say to God, you sure this belongs in my life right now? I didn't see it coming. Of course we didn't see it coming. So what? You just keep turning towards the light, and before you know it, you jump onto that magnet, and you are one with God's love, with God's light. You're embraced by his grace forever and forever.